It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're coming to you today and tomorrow from KPCC in Pasadena, California, and it's great to be here. On Monday, California Attorney General Javier Becerra announced a coalition of 16 states would be suing the federal government over the Trump administration's declaration of a national emergency.
He knows this is not a national emergency. He even said in that state, in that announcement,
and we will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit, even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court, just like the ban.
I think he's going to be wrong on all these different counts when it comes to where he can go. But we'll do what we have to do. If Congress won't set him straight, then we'll go to court to make sure that we make him respect the rule of law.
Both sides are digging in for a protracted legal battle, and even if President Trump does win out, it could be a while before he gets funding for the wall. Here to walk us through what happens next is Jennifer M. Chacon, a law professor at UCLA, and Danny Savalas, a legal analyst with MSNBC. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Danny, let's get started with you. So much happening here. What legal argument are these 16 states trying to make in this lawsuit?
There are a couple different arguments. One is that there was never really a national emergency if, and this has two prongs, the president spoke about it for many, many months, even years, and never did anything about it. And part two, if he said in so many words, I didn't need to do this, that also undermines the existence of a national emergency. The second argument, and I think probably ultimately the stronger argument for the state's lawsuit, is not so much can the president declare a national emergency, it's where is he going to get the money to pay for this stuff? But I have to say, as a preliminary issue, a threshold determination that any court is going to have to make, and by any court, I mean all the way up the appeals courts and up to the Supreme Court, is going to be an issue called standing. In other words, do the states have any business suing the federal government to tell it what to do with its own federal military spending and funds? I think that may be one of the early battlegrounds in this lawsuit for the states, because historically, it's not exactly clear that states have a right to sue the federal government on behalf of its citizens or to change government, federal government policy.
And Jennifer, I want to ask you, from your perspective as a constitutional law professor, what kind of legal questions does the president, on the president's side, does his declaration of a national emergency bring to mind?
So it raises a number of legal issues that are very interesting, and I think it raises a memory of a similar incident that happened in the 1950s with President Truman when he declared a national emergency and attempted to seize the steel mills. There was a labor action that threatened to close down all of the nation's steel mills. There was an ongoing war in Korea, and President Truman said, there's an emergency, we really need steel production, and so I'm going to seize the mills. And he attempted to do so and was sued. And the Supreme Court actually said that he had exceeded his constitutional authority in seizing the mills. And what they said in that case was, we're dealing with a situation where, in fact, Congress has thought about this issue, has declined to provide emergency powers to the president around this issue, has declined to write legislation that would seize the steel mills, and has made the determination that it's not necessary. And so the president here is acting without express constitutional authority, without statutory authority, and in contravention of congressional decision making. Therefore, he's acting at the lowest ebb of his power, and that could be comparable to the situation that we're in here.
And I'm just curious, like, in terms of where, when we look at the declaration itself, how unprecedented it is estimation.
So he's made the declaration under the National Emergencies Act, and we do know that many presidents have used the National Emergencies Act in a variety of situations, usually to deal with funds for a small number of people who have been accused of terrorist activities, those sorts of things. We saw George W. Bush do it, obviously, in response to the attacks of September 11th, 2001. But this kind of a large-scale declaration of a national emergency in a situation where there's slow-moving events and no actual emergency is absolutely unprecedented.
And Danny, what the law lawsuit is being filed here in the Northern District of California. We're here broadcasting this week. Why here?
Anytime you have a lawsuit like this that could be brought in any of many different federal districts, there's always a strategic reason why. I don't think President Trump's attacks on the Ninth Circuit and the courts in California and elsewhere in the Ninth Circuit are really warranted. The Ninth Circuit isn't some leftist branch of the judiciary, as Trump has accused it of. But strategically, they've decided that based on the case law or whatever the case may be, they have the best advantages filing in the Northern District of California. But I have to say, the challenge here, and believe me, I say this in a way auditioning for Professor Chacon, because my dream job is a UCLA adjunct professorship at the law school. So I'm choosing my words very carefully here. But
smart move, Danny. Smart move.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the key here in this case is going to be, as Professor Chacon discussed the famous steel mill case, is that case gave us a tripartite framework for deciding whether or not the president acts against the express will of Congress. But again, a preliminary determination has to be, do we even know which category the president's in? For example, it may be the case that the president is acting now and there are senators on both sides of the aisle who are speaking out against what the president is doing. And in that sense, it might be said that he's acting against the express will of Congress. But it could also be said that under certain authorizing statutes, like the two statutes that authorize military spending and military diversion of funds, that Congress has already given its express permission, something that was absent in the Truman steel mill case, where President Truman acted just based on his inherent constitutional authority. But here, expect the president's lawyers to say, no, no, no. It doesn't matter what congressional leaders say today. When they pass that law authorizing this spending at the moment that the president says the words national emergency, it's immaterial whatever else the president said in an offhand speech or whatever he tweeted or whatever individual senators say. Congress has expressly authorized this action. Therefore, the president acts at the peak of his power and his act is constitutionally valid.
Jennifer, also, does this fall in line? Because we know this is a very reactive president. When the president does not get what he wants, he will act. And I'm wondering, does this latest declaration fall in line with sort of this expanding authority of the executive branch, Jennifer?
Yes. So I think that this is a pretty typical move for this president to sort of use national security as a reason or justification for an expansive use of executive authority. And the problem that has just been identified is that Congress has really delegated a great amount of power to the executive branch through things like the National Emergencies Act. And President Trump has a very savvy way of taking advantage of these large grants of power that Congress has seemed to given to the president.
Danny, what is California arguing that how this declaration of a national emergency will help the hurt the state? Sorry.
You've seized on a key issue, and it goes back to that threshold issue of standing. Each and every state that is joined in this lawsuit must allege some concrete interest in the outcome of the litigation to even get into court. I can't stress how important standing is. You know, you look, and we're not talking about the other lawsuit, which involves landowners. They have a more clear path to standing. These are folks in another lawsuit that are having they're alleging their property is going to be taken from them to build this wall. That more fits the classic definition of standing, that constitutional requirement. But states like California and Connecticut, and the fascinating thing, if you read the complaint, each of them alleges slightly different effects on the state. For example, Colorado says, look, we've got the Air Force Academy, we've got all these bases. If you move those funds around, that affects us. Other states say, well, this will affect our drug interdiction, the funds that we use to fight the war on drugs. And then even other states say that this is diverting funds away from construction efforts or other things. But ultimately, they all have to affect the states. And that's the key. The reality is every single action that the federal government takes has some effect on the states. So the courts are going to have a bit of a challenge here. They're going to have to decide whether or not is any effect on the states, however remote, enough to give the state standing to challenge the federal government in court. It's a battle that the states could possibly lose.
Well, and there's another element of news here. We just heard yesterday that, or just last night, that the Trump administration said it plans to terminate a $929 million federal grant to the California High Speed Rail Authority. Now, in terms of explaining this on Twitter, the president said, basically tied this decision to the wall and said the failed fast train project in California, where the cost overruns are becoming world record setting, basically saying that this is way too expensive. Is this, Danny, direct retaliation that we're seeing here by the president?
You could easily call this retaliation. But in fairness, the federal government has oftentimes used the spending power instead of a direct order to the states in order to get its policy done. This has happened historically many times. For example, the drinking age in the United States is uniformly 21. The federal government made that happen. How? They didn't order the states to do it. They didn't have the power to do that. But instead, they said, hey, states, if you like federal highway funding, everybody better make their drinking age 21, or else you're not getting any of our federal highway funding. And you know what? Within a short period of time, with I believe Louisiana as the last holdout, all the states had to fall in line. While this could easily be perceived as an act of retaliation by Trump, at the same time, historically, the federal government has often used its spending power as a crowbar to get the states to do that which the federal government cannot order the states or commandeer them to do otherwise.
I just want to get one thought in from Jennifer here. How long do you think this process is going to take?
The litigation process? Well, it could take a while. I mean, I think Trump is right that it will be slow moving through the courts, which is ironic given the fact that he has tried to posit this as a national emergency. On the question of whether the states can actually bring these lawsuits, I think it's true that they do need to be able to demonstrate some sort of harm. But it's worth remembering that on much more speculative questionable harms, the Supreme Court allowed them to challenge President Obama's deferred action for parents in Texas versus United States. It looks like the state's harms here are more real and more quantifiable than the harms that they were able to articulate in that case. So it seems like they have some good precedent to articulate a claim of standing in this case.
Jennifer M. Chacon is a law professor at UCLA, and Danny Savalas is a legal analyst with MSNBC. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're broadcasting today from KPCC studios in Los Angeles. And here in California, there's a very real emergency that's visible on city streets: homelessness. 1 in 4 homeless Americans live in California, and there are about 50,000 homeless people living in and around Los Angeles alone. But for the first time in a long time, LA actually has the funds on hand to deal with the crisis. And here with me in the studio to talk about where that money's going and what it will take to fix the problem is Matt Tinoco, KPCC's housing and homelessness reporter. Great to have you here, Matt.
Hi, Tenzina.
So homelessness obviously is not a new problem in LA, but right now there's this weird thing where they actually have money to fix it. Like, where did the money come from?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a new problem at all. And it's basically the money came from the voters. It's a big deal because the presence of a revenue stream for local governments to deal with this problem is really pretty new, and it's pretty unique in the country, actually.
So tell me a little bit about the voters. Like, was it a question of wanting to help the homeless population? Were there other reasons for this? Had it gotten to a point where LA residents were uncomfortable? Like, what drove this?
I think it's a lot of what you said, but especially that last one. I mean, I'm reading a bunch of books from the 80s about homelessness, and LA is called the homeless capital of America in the early 80s. And it hasn't changed since then. The underlying economic factors that drive folks into homelessness, they're all still here. It's the same status quo as it was in 1983. It's just that the problem has been continuing to get worse for the past 30 years. So now you basically have, instead of homelessness in a few corners of the city, it's really everywhere, including in high-income neighborhoods. And that's, I think, why a proposal was made to the voters to say, hey, we can do something about this locally. And they signed off on, it's almost $5 billion over the next 10 years to deal with homelessness.
And that's billion with a B.
Billion with a B for the city and county of Los Angeles.
So it became something that the voters couldn't ignore wherever they were, and they decided to deal with it. One of the things about Los Angeles is that a lot of homeless people don't live in shelters. They're out on the streets, and I think, you know, in New York, I think we often think about LA as being this warm place where it's okay to be out in the street. That's not true. People are suffering. suffering, even though the temperature is a little higher than it is where we're from.
Yeah, I mean, it might be higher, but like it's wintertime right now, right? The past couple of weeks, it's been rainy and it's been cold. The overnight lows have been in the 30s. And, you know, tents aren't waterproof. So imagine it's raining on somebody and now it's an overnight low in the 30s. You have wet blankets. That's not going to keep you warm. The LA Times actually did an article just over the past weekend about how more homeless people die of hypothermia in Los Angeles County than in New York. And that's basically because of what you just said. New York has a much more robust shelter system than Los Angeles and Southern California does. And well, the result of that is that we have this massive unsheltered crisis on the streets. And people are very, very susceptible. It's not just exposure, but I actually have the coroner death data for LA County. Coroner keeps track of when homeless folks die on the streets. And it's really, every individual case is really sad. You have exposure, but you also have things like car crashes, right? Like people live in tents on the sidewalks and on freeway off-ramps. And well, those are places very, the tents aren't car-proof either.
So what's the goal with this money? I mean, is the goal to get folks into a shelter system? Is it to improve the shelter system? Is it to get them in permanent housing? What exactly is the goal?
The goal is permanent housing. The problem, though, is that building the permanent housing, it takes time. And I think there's a present tense discussion happening in Southern California that, okay, so we've earmarked a lot of money to build permanent supportive housing, homes for folks who in another era would have been institutionalized. But the problem is that takes a long time. And we have this humanitarian crisis on the streets. Hmm. That's unresolved. It's a present tense discussion. But the thought is maybe we do have to expand the shelter system just to get people off the streets. People in shelters are not, they're still homeless.
And the issue here is also, you know, we've also seen reporting about folks who do get off the streets who may not be ready to deal with, you know, everything that comes with living in a full-time residence. Is the city really prepared to, have they thought out what they're going to do with this and as far as all the different steps to getting folks, you know, housed?
It's funny you say steps, because the process to get somebody into permanent housing is, the manual to do it is so thick. There's step after step after step after step, and it's a sort of hurry up and wait situation. There are so many smart people who are working on this issue and for the first time do have the financial wherewithal to actually move policy and actually like do experimental programs to try and reach specific subsets of the population, because there's so many different types of people. There's no one type of homelessness.
You spoke to a woman named Dorit, and she's a low-income landlord who spent many years working with the LA homeless sector. Mm-hmm. Let's take a listen.
And we are housing people. Okay, we are getting people off the streets. But there's always this influx, and it's not an influx of people coming from Minnesota. It's people coming from here who are losing their housing. And it just stumbles. Now they're on the street.
Is the city prepared to deal with that stumble?
That's the really hard thing, because a lot of our infrastructure is designed to basically address folks once they are currently homeless and on the street. But that doesn't do anything to address the bigger, really the macroeconomic factors that continue driving more people into homelessness.
And what are some of those?
Wages have not increased. Housing costs have really dramatically increased. And since, again, the 80s, the social safety net that in the past would have helped folks in that position, it's no longer here. And now the result is it's basically on local governments to try and do that. But local governments can't address the economy in a way that, say, the federal government could, which it puts them in this hard position. It's, okay, we have so many people. Like in LA County, the stat is that LA County has 10 million people in it. 600,000 folks in Los Angeles County live in living situations where 90% of all the income goes to housing, just to keep the roof over the head.
What's the community reaction been? What have, you know, the people who are actually going to be impacted by this saying?
You know, it's you can't ignore this anymore, which that's what we've done for the past 30 years. And it's reaching a sort of point where I think everybody in the city is kind of realizing that, oh, you know, we are responsible. Dorit is one of those folks. She has a neighborhood homeless coalition that she founded with a number of her other neighbors. And the idea is basically just to learn who their homeless neighbors are. When you see people on the street, they're often from that area. They aren't coming from somewhere else. They stay in areas where they're comfortable and they feel safe. So they're usually longtime locals. So other neighbors are basically coming around and saying, hey, we should get to know these people and we can try and give them blankets and food. And also the acknowledgement that blankets and food does not end homelessness. Like it might address their immediate condition right there. But then really to start advocating for the bigger things that actually can get that person off the street. That's for permanent housing. That is for just shelters that can get people off the street so they have a safe place to go in, you know, when it's rainy and in the 30s outside and things like that.
Matt Tinoco is KPCC's housing and homelessness reporter. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Back with you here on The Takeaway, I'm Tanzina Vega, live from KPCC Studios in Los Angeles. Did you learn a foreign language in school?
My name's Judy Rosenzweig. I'm calling from Los Angeles. So I learned German. I was raised in Milwaukee. I think that learning a foreign language awakens and exercises an important part of a young brain, and that can definitely have a lifelong impact.
This is Rick from Gainesville, Florida. I did learn Spanish growing up in South Florida. It was essential, extremely helpful, and something I'm glad I was able to do. Unfortunately, being here in Gainesville, not a lot of opportunity to use it.
This is Gina. When I was in school, our choices were Latin and Spanish. Now, the only choices you have is Spanish and Italian.
This is Dave Parent from Redwood City, California. I did not learn a foreign language in my K-12 years. As an adult, I've always felt a bit deficient for not having become proficient in another language just because it seems to be so relevant to having an understanding of other people besides Americans.
And as it turns out, Dave is not alone. Because in the United States, there are fewer and fewer foreign language classes available to students at the K-12 level and in higher ed. In fact, only about 20% of Americans today study a second language in school compared to nearly 100% of Europeans. Some experts blame this on budget cuts in public schools and the lingering effects of the recession on education. But that's not the only possibility.
Interest is a key point. Many people who speak English as their first language, and that's really Anglophones around the world, but especially here in the U.S., tend to think that everyone speaks English. And the truth is that 75% of the world's population does not speak English.
Kathleen Stein-Smith is Associate University Librarian and Adjunct Faculty at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and she's also the chair of the American Association of Teachers of French Commission on Advocacy. And we sat down to explore this decline in foreign language offerings and what it means for our students in our country and what some are trying to do to change that.
I think Americans, we've always had sort of an interesting relationship with other languages. The U.S., although people from around the world always came to this country, we've always been a nation of immigrants. Paradoxically, we're not really strong in terms of speaking other languages. Historian Peter Stern termed it our indifference being legendary, our reluctance to learn foreign languages as being legendary. And I think it's in part because of distance. Back in the day, people came to America and in many ways lost contact with their heritage. That has dramatically changed. And I think we felt that sense of isolation. Really, at the end of World War I, there was a tremendous rise in isolationism as a U.S. policy, as well as the way of thinking of many Americans.
Can you talk a little bit about the demographic shift and who is really being affected by the lack of second language learning classes here?
You know, there's one thread in the different research, the different areas of research surrounding foreign language learning, that bilingualism especially benefits the low-income child.
And is that because of opening up job opportunities? Or because we also know that there's research that shows that bilingualism and speaking other languages is good for development.
You know, it absolutely is. It's wonderful for cognitive areas like executive function, divergent thinking, creativity, problem-solving, decision-making. Now, whether you're a child who speaks a language other than English in the home, and therefore you're bilingual, or whether you're learning a second language, whether you're an English-speaking student learning a second language, it's also great for your self-esteem.
I'm thinking about the importance that we put on language learning in this country versus in, say, Europe. What do you think are some of the differences there?
First of all, everybody needs to remember that multilingualism is a core value of the European Union. And it plays out in practice as what they call plurilingualism or mother tongue plus two. Now, on the national level, that becomes really national language learning mandates. And although each country differs, nonetheless, throughout Europe, in the 95% range of students actually are learning at least one additional language, usually from the elementary level on. So by the time they are finished with high school, they have proficiency. And I think that's one of the key factors in what is happening in our college programs. We don't have children learning languages from an early age, whether in a traditional foreign language program or through immersion. So therefore, at the university level, you don't really have students who have acquired proficiency and who are ready to take pre-professional courses. Language and culture, for example, in the STEM disciplines, in business, in addition to the language services industry, careers like translation and interpreting. We have language services companies, for example, three of the five largest language services, that means translation and interpreting and localization, three out of the five largest in the world are headquartered in the U.S. Many jobs go unfilled. In our government, in the diplomatic services, many jobs go unfilled. But it's not just diplomacy in the military. If you look at the Government Accountability Organization reports, if you look at reports that have come out of the Center for Economic the Committee for Economic Development, it's really across the disciplines, across government departments, and not only at the federal level, but then you look at your state and municipal services. There are jobs for which there just are no qualified applicants.
And you also say it could be an issue of national security as well.
Absolutely. If our diplomats, if our government officials, if no one has the ability, for example, to listen to the news, to read a newspaper, to look at a website, to understand a conversation without going through in a sense, the process of having a translator or a translation. And that's not to criticize translators, but it's not the same as hearing it yourself, as understanding the nuances. Why does one person choose one word rather than another to say the same thing, one synonym rather than another? There's nothing like understanding the words that people are saying. You know, history is full of stories of mistranslations also.
This is very true. If parents are listening to this segment and they're concerned that their kids might be missing out on the opportunity to learn a second language or maybe even a third language, what can they do?
We need the help of parents. You know, foreign language educators really have been speaking out, have been writing. They've even gone to Washington. But honestly, there's no one who loves their child more than the parent. And we need parents and communities to come out in support of languages also. We need the help of parents and communities. The beautiful thing about American education is that it is largely determined at the local level, the school district level. Decisions are made. We don't have one mandate from on high. So there is the opportunity for a community to actually come out, have a dialogue with school administrators, and get a program started. You know, in any neighborhood in the United States, there are people who speak languages other than English. And there's no better way to talk to your neighbor, to talk to a local business person, than if you understand their language.
Kathleen Stein-Smith is Associate University Librarian and Adjunct Faculty at Fairleigh Dickinson University and Chair of the American Association of Teachers of French Commission on Advocacy. Kathleen, gracias por su tiempo.
Gracias a usted igualmente.
When I went to school, I had to take Latin and a choice of Spanish or French. They all helped me when living in multicultural cities like New York, when traveling, or when trying to figure out the core meaning of words from their roots. My name is Joyce Artati. I'm calling from Snohomish, Washington.
My name is Mary. I'm calling from New York City. I just wanted to say, as a child, I learned Spanish in school as well as in my neighborhood. I went on to become an ESL teacher and advocate. Being bilingual has informed my work as an educator and made me more empathetic to the struggles of someone learning a very hard language that English is.
Joey, Denton, Texas. I took Latin as a sophomore in high school. It does help with root meanings and understanding certain words. But really, for the most part, every 6 weeks we would have a cultural experience where we would basically bring in baked goods and dishes from around the world and eat. That's really what I took away from.
Hi, this is Chella from Beaverton, Oregon. Studying a foreign language taught me so much about English in addition to exposing me to other cultures. Everyone should study a foreign language for at least a couple years. Thanks.
That's all for today. We'll be back with you tomorrow out of KPCC in Los Angeles. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.